Mark My Words shares Mark Homer's contrarian views on investing, business, finance, economics, and all things money. Mark interviews the world's most successful business, finance, and money experts, as well as imparting his knowledge in a factual, direct, and no-nonsense manner. Welcome to Mark My Words. And here is your host, Mark Homer.
Hi, and welcome back to Mark My Words. I've got David Kemp here with me. This is part two of the David Kemp Planning Consultancy podcast. I'm going to do another interview, dig into his mind a little bit more. He's got a lot of new insights. He's in our communities and some other sort of property developer, property investor communities now, and providing a lot of value. So, David, welcome back.
Thanks, Mark. Good to see you again.
You've been busy since we last spoke on various projects. Mm-hmm. I know you've got some case studies to talk to us about.
Yeah.
A few little cheeky things that people have been up to. Some that have worked, some that haven't. So, first of all, right back to the beginning. If we just rewind to the beginning of a process when you're looking at a building.
Sure.
You're looking to develop it and you want to get planning permission. Mm-hmm. Somebody decides they need a planning consultant.
Yep.
How do they pick that planning consultant to make sure they get the right one?
Well, there's a number of considerations, Mark, that it's probably worth taking into account. Mm-hmm. First of all, it depends upon what I would probably call your prime risk factors. So things like location, the size, the complexity of the development. I think that some of those things are also can be complicated by other issues, matters of what we call matters of principle, things like whether or not there are heritage constraints, whether or not you're in the green belt, whether or not there are changes of use. Changes of use is a common one as well. Some people buy commercial buildings looking to change into residential. There may not necessarily be either full or partial permitted development rights on them. So you may not necessarily be able to leap from where you are on the commercial use straight over to the residential use without going through a number of hurdles first. And so it's worth having a planning consultant involved at the very early stages, my preference is usually as soon as possible, in order to be able to do due diligence on those issues, to play devil's advocate on some of them as well and on the evidence that's available, and to try and help to put a strategy together as well, particularly if they're working in larger teams, say with architects and the like. Location and cost is an interesting one as well. Sometimes it's worth having a consultant involved, depending upon the size and the cost and the complexity of the scheme, even if it's a consultant who might not necessarily be in the same town as the development itself. They can work with the architect or other people who are involved on the ground who can help to monitor that. And you can structure things in a certain way so that the development and the project management of the planning side can still be coordinated. So there's a number of factors you probably need to take into account. Generally speaking, as a planning consultant, I like to kind of just generally work within the team. I don't necessarily see my role as a replacement for other experts and other consultants, including the architect in the team. It's about getting the right fit and making sure it all works well together.
So your preference would be to be instructed right at the beginning before the property is even purchased?
Usually, yes, and particularly if there are potential latent enforcement issues, you need your consultant to be able to advise on that. Potential for lawful use and permitted development, because that can help in terms of strategy. Also, another thing that sometimes tends to happen is if it's part of your strategy, say for instance to buy office buildings and to try and convert them to residential and under permitted development. And this is by way of example, if you ask the client to provide you with a local land charges search and the site survey search straight at the front, this is very early days, it's usually before the exchange of contracts takes place, then as a consultant you can advise the client on what the risks will be in the permitted development, for example, whether or not they're going to need contamination reports, noise reports, flood risk reports, transport and highways reports. Because some of these things are pulled out from that kind of information, some of them are pulled out from other sources as well. So it's quite helpful in terms of being able to then figure out the strategy, what the costs should be, who needs to be instructed, and when.
Okay, so we're going to sort of talk about some case studies now,
yeah.
And some things that you've been involved in specifically. This first one is somewhere where a developer's been a bit cheeky. he's had a bit tried a bit of a cheeky turn.
Yeah.
And it's backfired.
Yeah.
I think you've got a word for it in Yiddish.
Chutzpah.
Chutzpah. Yes. I couldn't ever, admit to ever pulling any of these sort of little chutzpah manoeuvres. Certainly not with planning, anyway.
No, of course not. But
this guy's probably pushed things a bit far.
Yeah.
So it was a block of flats, and he's tried to use his permitted development rights, but he's not quite got it right. Talk us through where he went wrong and what he should have done.
So what happened was a client had bought a building. It's a two-storey building with pitched roof. It was in the London Borough of Brent. The building comprised two flats, one on ground, one on the first floor, and they extended the first floor flat into accommodation to the roof. So the top floor flat was a maisonette. So we've got a two-bed and we've got a three-bed. And that's the established use on the site. So what he wanted to do was he wanted to divide each of those flats down into separate rooms. So they would, in each case, they would be a small Class C4 HMO, which you can do.
So in planning terms, as long as there's not an Article 4
correct.
Direction
yeah.
order in
yeah.
place,
yeah.
he could have just taken each flat and converted it into a flat of up to six bedrooms.
In each case. Yes.
So 12 if there was space.
Indeed, yeah.
Not even bothered to contact the council, not required any planning permission, just done it with building regs under permitted development.
Absolutely, yeah. Usually best to get a certificate of lawfulness in any event afterwards, because it prevents people asking questions in any event afterwards. But that's not what he did. Or rather, that's not what the architect in this case and the builder working together, who didn't necessarily realise the distinction between one kind of use and another.
This is very common, though.
When you
talk to an architect and they think it's one thing, and your sort of builder gets involved, and before you know it, you've sort of veered off the path that enables you to stick within the planning rules.
Absolutely. Well, the language gets very loose. I mean, you're people talking about, well, are they bedsit rooms? Are they studios?
Yeah.
Well, we've got.
What does that mean?
Exactly. Well, studios could be non-self-contained or they could be self-contained.
Yeah.
You get people who say, well, each of the rooms, it may have its own kitchenette, it may have its own tea station, it may have its own ensuite. Well, a tea station is not enough.
No, but it's a sink, isn't it?
But if you have a sink and kitchen units, then that's enough.
It's the sink that does it.
And you could put a portable stove on top of that or a microwave.
Yeah.
But the council's got to walk in and just see the sink, the kitchen units,
together
with an ensuite. And it will take the view that behind the lockable door of that particular bedroom, should be a bedroom and nothing more, then they've got all the facilities they need for cooking, cleaning, washing. You may have a washing machine for the clothes downstairs, but that is not going to be enough, because the council are going to see kitchen and food preparation areas in there. They're going to see a bathroom, and they're going to say that is self-contained. And that is what happened in this case. There wasn't a separate kitchenette that was provided. If there had been en-suites in each of the rooms, would have been fine. They needed to be sharing, ideally, a kitchen between each of the floors. And so there had been an enforcement complaint. It was actually in relation to some other element that had been done. But that other element wasn't the issue. That wasn't the problem. It led to the officers coming down. They saw what had happened on the ground, and they thought to themselves, we wouldn't grant planning permission for this. The next question they come to is, well, what's the legal status of what's been done? So when you're in a situation where you've got two flats, that's the previous lawful use, and those two flats, they've been converted to something which is unlawful, which has not got planning permission. Not only is the new use unlawful, but the result of that is you then lose the right to go back to the two flats, unless the council issues an enforcement notice first. Then, of course, you have to go back to those two flats.
But if they don't issue an enforcement notice, then you're probably not going to do anything anyway, are you?
No, you probably won't do, and then you'd probably try and sit on it for 4 years, thinking that you've got permitted development. But the immunity provisions relate to the use time limits which are set out in the Town and Country Planning Act. And those use time limits for 4 years refer to dwelling houses.
Which is C3 only.
Which is C3 only. So if you are not in C3, you're a non-self-contained residential use of the land, then it's a 10-year use.
Because it's C4.
Because it's C4
HMO.
or it's a sui generis if it's a building
big
with
one.
Yeah, with a lot more non-self-contained units in. Mm. So you might not be able to sit on something for 10 years, or you might have bought something where you couldn't prove that it had been in that use for 10 years or part of that period beforehand. So we have the situation here in this particular case, and we tried various avenues to try and correct it. We tried to say to the council and then to a planning inspector, but actually it's more sustainable rather than to have to rip everything out and then take it back to the two flats, and then from there we could go on to permitted development, which that part of it the council didn't argue with, but it's trying to miss out the middle step. And the council and the inspectorate disagreed and said, no, you can't do that. You've lost your permitted development rights. You have to take it back to the two units that was there in the first place. And trying various avenues and bearing in mind the costs that had been spent on trying to do the works in the first place and then have to rip them out and all the professional fees and other costs and the lost revenue in terms of rent, all this costed near enough 9 to 12 months of time for the client and easily upwards of £50,000. And that's a small project.
Incredible. So he had to rip it out and go back to the two-bed flats?
Yes, yeah. Yeah. Mm. And I presume that from that point on, he just lost the will to want to go on to permitted development.
And I presume if he'd then run those for a number of years, he'd then get his permitted development rights back.
Well, as he goes back to the two flats, then once that's substantially completed, the day after he could go back onto this. That's the ridiculous thing about. That's why we wanted to miss out the middle step.
Yeah, but if they want to be, they can be pedantic just to cause problems. Yeah, he's obviously done the wrong thing. He's not got the right advice early enough, and then he's got himself into quite a bit of bother. Any other sort of interesting case studies you've got?
There are a couple that I've been working on recently as well. There is, and these demonstrate. Very well, actually, in the way in which planning consultants such as myself work well within a team, and particularly quite early on. So one of the cases that I'm looking at is a street in northwest London. There is a small infill development between a terrace of two houses. It's a classic situation where you get a terrace of houses running north to south and a terrace of houses running east to west, and there's a gap where you look over the rear gardens between the two terraces right on the corner of the street. And so what one person had done is they bought the site on the other side of the junction to us, and in that junction there was, in that gap, there was three or four old garages that were dilapidated, and there were all sorts of manner of antisocial problems that use of the land was giving rise to. And they managed to get planning permission to knock those garages down and infill that gap with a small house, about 2 to 3 bedrooms, but had a double basement. So very, very large development. We are, or have been, looking to do something similar on the other side of the junction. It's a very similar arrangement. And in fact, we're hidden further back behind trees. So The difficulty is that an architect might look at that situation and think, well, we can see what they've done on that site, on this other site. It should be possible to replicate the same on our side. However, a planning consultant might look at things very differently. This isn't a conservation area. And in conservation areas, it's important to sometimes preserve those what's called townscape gaps. And these are things that come up quite a lot. And so because as a planning consultant, we look at things in a slightly different way, we're trained more to look at the constraints first rather than the opportunities. build around those constraints, and when the freedom is there and defined within those constraints, then we can say, okay, we have free rein to design what we can, but within those constraints, rather than starting off with the opportunities that seem to be there, completely unrestrained, and then say, fine, okay, because they've got scheme A on that land, we can get scheme B on that land. It doesn't work.
You
like
see
that.
It. You see it all the time. You know, bought a building recently, and I had a couple of my professionals out there who remain nameless. And first thing is, oh yeah, the eaves up that side of that height and that side. So you must just be able to, you know, there's a precedent on both sides. You must just be able to go up to the same level.
Yeah.
It's way more complicated than that. And there's all sorts of other considerations
there
in the council and the conservation officer specifically in this instance is bothered about, like views to the cathedral. Actually, the ridge heights on either side.
Yeah.
Probably not that relevant.
But you raise a good point, because you wouldn't be saying the ridge heights on either side are not that relevant, and you have a reason for that. But that's because your mind has already looked at that. The whole point is you've got to be aware of those particular issues. And then once you are aware of them, you're playing devil's advocate. So you're trying to see how trying to anticipate how the planning officers might be thinking of those points, as well as perhaps neighbouring residents who will also throw their say into the mix as well.
Yeah.
And you're trying to anticipate these things and block off the escape routes for people coming to the party with other arguments. And so it's very, very useful to do that. And so in a situation, the example that I've just given you, my answer would still not be a flat no to development, but it would be a case of, these are the risks. Now, how do we address them? How do we deal with them? Can we present what happened on the other site in a slightly different way? Does that shape how we present the case on our site? So it's just a matter of trying to be a little bit more learned about what happens and what the various interplays are between considerations on a site. Another site that I've been dealing with is a much larger site. It's a development we're putting together for planning for about 110, 120 homes down in Farnborough with
houses,
a client.
Houses, flats?
Flats. It is an existing office building where we will probably try and argue vacant building credit and other affordable housing exemptions as well.
So it's not permitted development?
Now, this is the interesting thing. It could be permitted development, but the problem is, in some parts of the country, particularly in the south, where you have natural heathland and upland, you have the Habitats Directive that gets read into the permitted development regulations.
Yeah.
And you're shaking your head, but it's an added layer of legislation.
Either it is or it isn't.
But there's an added layer of legislation. Yeah. And sometimes you come across these things, and it is a learning process as well. To complicate matters even more, we've been looking at a site which is in one particular council area in Hampshire, and they are subject to the same environmental regulations, the same Habitats Directive. It's national law. It's been read into the General Permitted Development Order. It restricts it in exactly the same way as it restricts it for every other borough who's affected in the same way. However, they will accept permitted development. They will accept a planning application for prior approval to go from office to resi. They've granted them. But they've granted it subject to a planning condition that there needs to be alternative natural green space to the natural to the heathland and upland. So it's just a way of getting around that. So they make it subject to a planning condition that then needs to be fulfilled.
So you need to provide some green space?
You need to, yeah. Well, it's not just a question of green. Some green space.
106?
No, it's usually, we're talking about SANG. It's sites of alternative natural green space. And they have to tick various boxes that satisfy Natural England. And they're actually quite sizable areas. They have to comply with certain criteria. And they have to have quite a large capacity for recreation for the local area as well. So these things don't actually come up every Monday or Tuesday. It takes a lot of money and a fair bit of luck to see one of these things come to fruition. So you might have prior approval. you might have to sit on that prior approval for several years before you're actually in a position to be able to develop some of these sites out. But the point is that they will grant permitted development for it. You've got that certificate which says anytime in the next 3 years, if you can change the use in that this 3 years, as long as you comply with that condition, then you're okay.
And I suppose if you start on site,
yes,
you've actually banked that then, and you can effectively continue the development within any time period.
Well,
once
yes,
you start.
Yeah, you have to implement it, certainly within the 3 years, but it's rather more than that. You actually have to substantially complete the change of use within 3 years.
Oh,
it's different to planning
it
permission.
It is, right, yeah. Okay.
Planning permission, you just have to make a material start on site, but you don't. You can just leave it to groundworks and that's it, and then walk away,
yeah,
as a lot of people do. But with a prior approval, you actually have to affect the change of use or substantially complete the change of use, which is probably to around second fixing stage. There's no definitive case law on that, but it's a question of degree. We reckon usually to around second fixing stage. But the council that we're dealing with, they said we're not going to grant prior approval because of the SANG issue. Now, when I have directed them to what happens in neighbouring authorities, and they said, well, that's a matter for them, for their resourcing. So you have to get to understand the way in which that council works, what their rules of the game are. That requires a little bit of extra conversation, a little bit of probing and digging beforehand. But if those are the rules of the game, play along with them, go with them, because you're going to have to work with officers. If that's the way they work, that's the way they work. And in our case, with Rushmore Borough Council, for instance, Rushmore want to see a completed full planning application come to them in draft first. They'll run through all the paperwork. They'll test all the viability beforehand. This is even before it's submitted online. So you have a much heavier pre-app stage that's involved. And it's now about, at this point in time, where we are is we've done the pre-app. We've got the initial positive views of officers. It's all going in the right direction. Well, now we have to work through the viability, work out how much we have to pay towards SANG and management and monitoring payments called SAM, which is they're a bit like community infrastructure levy payments. They're like fixed tariffs that you have to pay. It sounds very bemusing, but
the whole point of permitted development is there is no SIL or 106 or...
But it's a creature
affordable.
Of another layer of statute. But the point is that you say that it's the whole point of permitted development is this. Well, the permitted development is a creature of law. And it's very clear within the legislation that's been drafted that you're fine, as far as permitted development goes, if you tick these boxes in terms of flood risk, highways, noise... and contamination in the scheme, other things being equal. But the law also makes clear that you also have to have regard to the Habitats Directive and its legislation in England as well. And there's no sign that with Brexit, a lot of these changes are going to be swept away and we're suddenly going to change the law
overnight.
That was all
a load of wishful thinking, wasn't
yes,
it?
I mean, the
whole bananas are... You know, they're bendy, you know, before the EU, and now they're not anymore, and this is nonsense,
yeah,
and they're going to come out of the EU, and all that stuff's going to go. I mean,
they're protectionist measures.
Yeah.
And to strip all this legislation away, I mean, let's be honest here, they're going to be fighting against the countryside lobby. They're going to be fighting against a lot of vested interests who this legislation was there to protect in the first place. And I think the government has already made clear that developers and other. Everybody else shouldn't expect wholesale change overnight. There's a massive, massive body of legislation to have to review. So this is the world that we are dealing with at this point in time. So that's one particular case. And another particular case that I just want to refer to quickly, which we can come to in a moment, because it's to do with office to residential and how much more difficult office to residential is becoming in some parts of the country. With councils working as much as they can within the existing legislation to put barriers in the way of developers.
Well, they're learning new tricks, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah.
They're learning ways of thwarting these applications because they don't like them in a lot of places.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. They're particularly using things like flood risk assessments and also parking and highways to try and put developers under pressure and to restrict them from introducing smaller units. And that's the thing that a lot of local authorities try and resist. They're trying to resist these smaller units which fall below nationally described standards. And by using things which are quite legitimate within the legislation, such as parking requirements and parking provision, pedestrian access, highway safety, and distance from bins, not the bin capacity, I must add, because that's not relevant to a office to residential development, but at a distance from the bins themselves. It's minutiae like this, which I just tear my hair out every, in every particular application. But these are the boxes one has to tick. One has to be very careful about doing one's due diligence on particularly larger sites where you are not providing one-for-one parking in relation to the number of units that you're providing. Generally speaking, if you're not providing one space per unit, then you need to think very carefully about, well, what's going to be the propensity for car parking in this area? That's when it becomes a little bit more of an art rather than a science. Parking and highways consultants look into this sort of thing in a quite detailed fashion. They'll look at the census data for the local area and see what car ownership is per household on average, and see whether or not there's any lessons, general ratios that can be drawn out of that in order to try and pull the parking provision down on site as low as you can. Certainly to within a level that you only have on site to serve the number of units that you want to bring forward. Then, of course, if you can bring it down any further, then that's a good thing as well. Because if you find that there's some planning potential for perhaps extra stories, for example, on the site, then that's going to have its own parking provision, or need to have its own parking provision as well. So if you've got a little bit of wiggle room in the figures and you've got the potential for further parking spaces to serve the new floor space that you want to get planning for afterwards, then that's another thing that you want to look to. But you're absolutely right. It is becoming a lot more difficult in some parts of the country. There are still parts of the country where there is such a pressure on housing supply from housing need that it's really not justifiable, and it's not possible for councils, either politically or at officer level, to try and put these restrictions in place.
Actually, they don't want to. Some councils, in our area here, they do have a policy of accepting these conversions, and they want more residential units, and they're targeted to get them. So they're probably more flexible. I generally find also in lower value areas, they're more flexible than in higher value areas. So as you go further towards London, often it becomes more difficult.
Yes. Well, obviously the cynic within me would also say that there are particular financial requirements that the councils will be missing out on if it passes through permitted development. They're going to be missing out on affordable housing, they're going to be missing out on community infrastructure levy if there's no change in the new built floor space, for instance. And in some parts of London, the affordable housing financial contribution per square metre or per unit is so high, then we're talking about councils missing out on millions and millions of pounds. And in the days where we're talking about local authority being so chronically underfunded and local resources, local services being so under pressure, I mean, this is an awful lot of...
Big issue.
This is a big issue for local authority. You can understand it from their side, from their point of view, but it's a pressure. And this pressure is fed through to government. So I spoke before about the Neighbourhood Planning Act, which came into force in April of this year. One of the things that's come out of this has been that the government is looking at the issue of office to residential again, not considering whether or not it wants to expand office to residential to new build. That has been a conversation that's been bouncing around a little bit in the corridors of Westminster.
But so what's been bouncing around? How would you extend it to new build?
So what they were talking about was this. At the time when office to residential was brought in, it was first of all, it was a 3-year permitted development right. So it was brought in 2013, it was due to expire in 2016. Only a few months before it was due to expire, the government said, actually, we're quite happy the way this has worked. Let's extend it. Let's make it permanent. In the sense that the permitted development right doesn't have a shelf life to it. It doesn't expire. However, of course, if you get a permitted development, you get a prior approval certificate, it has a 3-year shelf life on it. As we've said, you have to substantially complete in that 3 years. So at that time, when they were looking at trying to extend it, one other thing the ministers were looking at was whether or not it was possible to even loosen up permitted development for prior approval, office to resi prior approval, even more. Currently, as it is, you cannot get prior approval other than for changes of use. So you only submit floor plans normally. There are no elevational changes. So any window details, completely separate application. You want to change the roof, it's a completely separate application. So what they have been looking at is whether or not there is some degree of softening up of the legislation, some external changes that can be made as part of the permitted development changes. So for instance, with agricultural buildings, one can change the use of some agricultural buildings and make some external changes to the agricultural buildings which are sufficient in order to give effect to the change of use in the internal layout. So for instance, if you're changing the internal layout of a barn, for instance, and it falls within a permitted development use, you may need to punch some new window openings in. So those window openings shown on your new elevations, if they're consistent with the floor plan, they should pass through under permitted development for that. So the government have looked at whether or not it can do the same thing for offices, but also spoken about, looked at whether or not it can perhaps increase the limit or increase the freedoms even more. Perhaps look at whether or not you can do a knockdown and rebuild from offices to residential.
On the existing footprint.
On the existing, yes, on the existing. But this opens up all sorts of very complex planning considerations, such as issues of amenity, height, daylight, sunlight, design. And the difficulty with this is that one might have to put in another layer of approval before the prior approval stage to run it past neighbours to see if there's any initial objections.
Isn't this just a planning application?
It sounds like a planning application, yeah. I mean, you do have something similar with smaller residential developments. Say, for instance, you can go up to 3 metres out at the back and ground floor level on houses, or up to 8 metres out.
Oh, yes. Depending on that. And you have to consult with the neighbours.
You have to consult with the neighbours first. Yeah. So it's a prior approval stage. So there's a question of whether or not they can do that with offices. Nothing has really happened on that so far. And as I say, that idea is still bouncing around the halls of Westminster. Whether or not it ever sees the light of day, we don't know. But one thing that they have been looking at is whether or not the Secretary of State should intervene to stop the councils applying for Article 4 directions to remove the permitted development rights in their areas. With the changes that happened to office to resi in 2016 to make it a permanent provision, it also swept away some of the old restrictions that were in place, such as the statutory exemptions from the legislation. So some authorities had managed to get an exemption from the permitted development rights and got them into statute. So for instance, the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea, you can't apply for permitted development for office to resi in the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea anywhere in RBKC. It's quite unusual for a whole borough to be covered, but that was the case. I'm just using this as an example. So rather than that being an Article 4 area, Article 4 direction for the whole borough, it was a statutory exemption for the whole borough. So the government swept those away and said, well, we're not going to sweep them away immediately, but you've got 12 months. And within that 12 months, you're going to have to replace these with Article 4 directions. So it would be completely managed by Article 4 in future. After that 12-month period, you've still got the possibility of councils bringing in Article 4 directions. They're not time-barred from doing so at any stage in the future. Now, if they want to do so, the Secretary of State has a discretion not to allow the council to rubber stamp and authorise the Article 4. So the Secretary of State can intervene. So the Secretary of State has been reviewing in what circumstances he is going to intervene. And in those situations where you've got 100% affordable housing supply, and that supply is met even without permitted development completions, and there is a need to remove the permitted development restrictions for the well-being and amenity of the area, yet to be defined, but I'm thinking probably along the lines of the economy of the area. It's important to preserve offices for some economic, local economic reason. Then if all of those three conditions are met, the Secretary of State has indicated that he would tend to allow the Article 4 direction to be met. If any of them are not met, unfortunately the government hasn't been clear about whether or not the Secretary of State would still intervene to stop an Article 4 direction. So we're getting a little bit more certainty, but there's a lot more shape that needs to be put on it. This all relies upon data, on specific facts and figures. This information is being accumulated at the moment because we're still quite early in the legislative life of this change. And therefore what will happen is it'll be around November time this year that we'll start to see the Secretary of State considering whether or not he's going to step in and intervene in some circumstances.
Okay, so are there any new permitted development rights on the horizon, David, that we can see coming in the near future?
One thing that the government has been starting to look at is whether or not something can be done with regards to agricultural buildings and farmland. So they've been looking at quite small scale permitted development for agricultural buildings, but whether or not there's a possibility for permitted development conversion of up to 750 square metres, a maximum of five buildings each of up to 150 square metres for agricultural buildings. And they're also looking at whether or not, not just permitted development, but whether or not there's a potential for policy changes in terms of agricultural land as well. Because a lot of agricultural or countryside development is restricted by the limits of the established village settlement boundary. So whether or not there's a possibility that something could be done with regards to making those boundaries more flexible, whether or not there's something that can be done with how one classifies or regards farmland and farm buildings, whether or not they could be permitted development, for instance, whether or not they're regarded as previously developed land because there's been some sort of activity on the land, such as farming activities or agricultural activities, and the buildings themselves, whether or not they help to contribute to that as well. There have been also consideration, some discussion within the context of new build development, particularly, for instance, for office to residential, again, about possibly going up above the existing level of some buildings, whether or not one could go up another two stories on some buildings where the ridge height is uneven on either side. And so, for instance,
is that just on offices, or
That has been not just on offices? It could be on mixed use buildings. It could be on other buildings as well.
So air rights, in effect.
Air rights, yes.
Yeah. Anything on retail?
In terms of pub uses and how that relates to retail, there's actually been a movement in the other direction, away from permitted development rights. The current situation stems from the division of the retail classes into five key areas. So you've got A1, which is shops, A2, which is financial and professional services, banks, building societies, the like, with a ground floor retail presence. Restaurants, those which primarily serve hot food on the premises. Then you've got pubs or alcohol related uses, so it's wine bars as well. Then you've got takeaways, which are A5. Now the general rule has been that you could go from A5 to any of the others, A4 to A1, A2 or A3, mm-hmm. A3 to A1 or A2 and A2 to A1. So you can go up with, as we say, up the order. You can't go down the order. So it's a ratchet provision. It just goes in one direction. However, there has been an issue in this country about the loss of pubs, which is probably more relevant in some regions than it is for, to others. In some in some areas of the country, there isn't so much pressure on pubs. There's probably too many of them in some areas. But certainly my experience in London has been where there has been a shortage of pubs in certain areas, and particularly pubs which have a certain character to a local area. They may be regarded as buildings of merit or locally listed. Then there's a lot of pressure locally and nationally to try and retain pubs. And a lot of this campaigning has come from organisations and bodies like the Campaign for Real Ale and other amenity societies on the ground. What has happened is that, particularly I think a lot of your listeners would have heard of something called the Assets for Community Value Register. So basically what this is it's an opportunity for local groups to have certain buildings classed as so important to the local community because they're a hub for the local community, they provide social networking opportunities. They might not necessarily be an actual community use within any of the Class D uses, like assembly and leisure halls and church halls, so on and so forth. But they're still for a hub for social activity. And a lot of pubs do perform this function, particularly rural pubs. And so what local groups do is they class them or try to get them nominated as classed as assets for community value. Now that impedes the sale of those uses, but it also means if they're on the register as an ACV, then you cannot go from the pub use to, for instance, restaurant use under permitted development. The Campaign for Real Ale, though, has been campaigning and saying that the difficulty with this is that it just restricts it to those which are on the register. There are a lot of pubs which are not on the register, either they've not been nominated and they're not on there yet, or we don't know when they will be there. And that as a result, those pubs might still be lost. So in the Neighbourhood Planning Act, again, the government changed the law on this. It's withdrawn permitted development rights for pubs. It meant that you now cannot go from any pub, even one that's not on the ACV register, to restaurants, shops, or financial and professional services. It's also introduced a new use class. And this is where the law, to my mind, gets a little absurd and rather difficult. But it's introduced a new use class called Class AA, which is about drinking establishments with an extended food provision.
Well, where's the line?
Well, who's to say exactly? Where is the line?
What is extended? Is it a food provision of 200 metres squared?
Or absolutely.
150? Do they sort of define any of that?
Well, it's almost too close to say to what degree that interferes with or crosses over into a restaurant use. Mm. Because you've got a lot of restaurants that
30% pub, 70% restaurant.
Exactly. You've got a lot of restaurants that have got alcohol and entertainment licences, but they're restaurants. They're regarded as A3.
And it could have started with 100 tables and chairs, and 6 months later it went to 50 tables and chairs.
Absolutely,
and,
yeah. So my advice to your listeners is, if you've got a pub which serves food, then you're going to try and argue as much as you can, use any evidence such as seating covers, how much money it makes from different parts of its business, what its opening hours are, what its clientele's like, what its menu's like, its website, and how it markets itself, for instance. You use all of this to try and get it into A3. Because if you're in A3, then you are not so restricted in terms of the freedom of movement out of A3 to other uses. Once you're in Class AA, then you can't move anywhere unless you apply for planning permission.
And A3, remind us what use
is,
class?
That's restaurants. So basically restaurants, where there is primarily the consumption of hot food on the premises. So they can have cold food.
It's probably how it looks as well, isn't it? I mean, if it's the Dog and Duck and it sort of, you know, it looks like a pub.
Yes.
The planning officer is going to say it's a pub and it's A4.
Yes.
Though technically it might not be.
No.
But this sort of.
But where do you draw the line? Mm. I mean, for instance, you've got a very well known pub called the Fat Duck in Bray.
Mm.
And
that's a restaurant.
That's a restaurant. Everybody knows it as a restaurant.
Yeah.
But some of these pubs
the
on
one
the
opposite that's owned by the same proprietor is a pub, but has sort of pub food in it.
Yeah.
But you know how you would define that in strict planning terms, I don't know. I don't quite know.
I don't
how
know
you do
how.
That.
I don't no. know. And these all so have to be tasted.
But as soon as something's tasted. A bit grey, you know, there's an opportunity there to sort of. Yeah. Twist it around to
absolutely
something that helps yourself.
Yes.
But you need somebody to help you do that.
Yeah.
Okay, so lots of ideas there, lots of different ways in which we can get permitted development.
Yep.
Or utilise it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Sometimes we apply for planning permission or we don't, mm-hmm. and you know, the council encourages a retrospective application. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes mm-hmm. your planning application just doesn't work,
mm-hmm.
but you know, or your consultant or the professionals helping you are basically saying, look, you should have got planning on this, but they're just being difficult or they're incorrect or whatever. So you might decide to appeal.
Mm.
Do many planning appeals work? Is it worth appealing?
I'm not sure what the up-to-date statistics are across the board on this, because this has not been published and kept quite so up to date by the planning inspectorate as it used to be. But I would say that on average, probably about 50 to 60% of appeals do succeed. But the statistics, in my mind, are largely meaningless because it depends upon the quality of the appeal that was bought. Appeals get bought for all sorts of reasons. For instance, in enforcement appeal cases, I have clients who might ask me to take an enforcement appeal on and submit an appeal against an enforcement notice, not because they actually believe the enforcement notice will succeed. What happens with an appeal in those cases is the council then can't take any action until the enforcement matter is decided. So it keeps them in the premises for perhaps another year while they play the system and make more money out of the premises, or give them time to get vacant possession, whatever they have to do. So there's all sorts of reasons why. But in terms of appealing against decisions, I'd say that it can be helpful. It can be particularly helpful in cases where you have effectively run up against a brick wall with a local lobby, where the council's officers and their members are perhaps so ingrained with local opinion, and that local opinion is, at best, it's arguable, or it might be completely wrong, that the only way that you can get away from the council's intransigence is to take it to an independent and impartial body. And that's the planning inspectorate.
If you take it to a planning, or take it to the planning inspector,
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
the planning inspector sort of comes out on site,
yep.
has a look round,
yep.
I presume, same thing, you need to have a consultant do it for you. Can be quite time consuming.
It can be quite time consuming. With appeals, you have different stages. With the usual planning appeal, it has to be submitted within 6 months of the decision.
Of the original decision.
Of the original
from
decision.
From the local authority.
Absolutely, yeah. With a householder appeal, that's where there's no change of use, it's just building works to a dwelling house. Then when the decision has come through, you then have 12 weeks to appeal, and it's an expedited service, so there's not much you can say in terms of grounds of appeal on that. You can submit something, but you're quite limited to a degree. But with a normal planning appeal, what happens is you actually have to do your planning statement first and everything else. And for instance, if you need a heritage statement, that needs to go in at the same time. All this is loaded up to the planning appeal website. It can be very time consuming, can be very costly, but it's still quicker on the whole than how it used to be, where you used to submit your appeal. Then you'd have a period of time to submit your papers and your full appeal statement after the forms were submitted. But it takes a long time to get through the appeal process. This is the problem, this is the point. Because with planning appeals, if you submit an appeal, say for instance, we're dealing with one at the moment, which is merely written representations. It's the lowest, easiest, should be the quickest form of appeal. Because you've got written reps, then an informal hearing, then a full-blown public inquiry. Now, written reps cases should take roughly 5 to 6 months from the date that they are validated, what's called the start letter. The planning inspectorate will send you a letter as soon as they've been through your application and your papers and say, yeah, everything all seems to be appear in order. We've got all the plans that we need, all the documents that we need. We've got your grounds of appeal. We've got your statement. The whole thing's now going to kick off, and this is your appeal timetable. This is what the council needs to do next. This is what you need to do next, and this is the order in which it goes. So they settle that out, and that is called a start letter. But there is a gap in time between when you submit your papers online and when you get your start letter. And that whole validation or technical process can take weeks, it can take months. I've got one at the moment where we've only just received the start letter and it took 2 months to actually get that start letter after we submitted the appeal. Now, once you get the start letter, you've probably got another 6 months to the decision. On more complex appeals, it might take a little bit longer because you've got to wait for an inspector to be allocated to it. It's got to be the right inspector. It depends who's available and what their resourcing is and whether or not they're tied up on another appeal or inquiry. And with informal hearings, it's a bit longer. With full-blown public inquiries, we're talking about 12 months, really. I mean, 12 to 14 months. So it can take a very long time. And so for that reason, if you think you're going to be in a situation you may have to go to appeal, it's very important to try and bag a consent first from the council. So we talk sometimes about duplicate and parallel applications, and I know that you wanted to ask me about this as well. We are talking about running our application strategy with the appeal in mind and not going gung-ho into submitting an application and saying, well, whatever happens, we'll get this through on appeal. Because you actually have to be a little bit more sophisticated in your thinking than that.
Vacant building credit. Have you had much success with that? Have you seen many successes? I know it's relatively early doors for it, but it's for use in areas where, or on buildings that you're not able to achieve permitted development. But if it's an empty building and it's commercial and you're converting it to residential, in broad terms, you don't have any affordable housing on the square footage that you took away.
Yes, you can reduce your exposure to affordable housing.
Does it work usually?
It can do, but it's still very, very early days. And the situation we are in at the moment, is I think I mentioned to you, the development that we're doing down in Farnborough. We went to see the officers, and to a certain extent, affordable housing will be less of an issue there because they're actually more concerned to make sure they get financial contributions through, not for affordable housing. Their priority is more towards financial contributions towards alternative natural green space. Mm-hmm. So again, it comes back to knowing what the local priorities are, doing your homework, speaking to officers, lobbying with them, or doing pre-apps. But interestingly, we also asked them about vacant building credit.
Had they heard of it?
They had heard of it, but it's not in their local plan. And this won't be unusual.
As haven't heard of it,
no.
Or hadn't, and sort of looked a bit confused about it all. But, yeah. Actually, the guy that deals with the contributions and his boss, neither had heard of it.
Yeah. No, it's remarkable. Yeah. It is remarkable. But the thing is, it's been around.
But that tells me it's good.
But it's been around for years.
Because remember this with PD. Yeah. I got my first PD application in 2013. I think it was the first one in Peterborough. And I think I did the third one as well. And I remember initially it was all a bit, they didn't really want to admit
they had this.
Yeah, they didn't want to admit anything, but it sort of came back and yeah, fine. And the bank even said you couldn't do it, and the solicitor, and they call it, and actually when you're early doors with some of this stuff, it's the best time because it's they think of all the ways to stop you and all the problems later.
Sometimes you don't even have to be early doors with it. I mean, we're dealing with a borough in London, and we had to resubmit an application in relation to an office conversion because it turned out that they had missed out from their planning records for the last few months and actually wasn't declared in their local land charges search either, an application that was granted for part of the building to go to D1 use back in 2010. And so they had a record that was 7 years old that wasn't on their local land charges register, wasn't on their online planning reasons. Now, I won't go into all sorts of implications there in terms of appeals and costs and that sort of stuff. But the reason I mention it is because we had to go back to them for a resubmission to say, okay, well, we're only applying for part of the building to be changed to offices now. The rest of it, okay, we'll keep as D1. And they said, well, you can't apply for prior approval under part of the building. And I'm just incredulous at this because actually it's as clear as day in the act that, of course, you can do. I pointed it out to them. They still insisted. And this is probably one of the most irritating things about some local authorities, that they
just don't know.
They just don't know. They insisted on all sorts of protectionist measures for highways, Section 106, planning conditions. RQC said to us, I don't know why they're asking for Section 106s. The legislation was passed in order to expedite planning and development. And therefore, they shouldn't be saying, well, we need another 2 or 3 months in order to get a Section 106 together and get that through. You can put a planning condition together which says no development shall take place unless you have this on site first or this has been done first. So you could do a negatively worded condition. So it could all be dealt with by planning conditions. It doesn't need Section 106. And we've told them this. At another point, actually, probably your listeners would be very interested to hear, is, of course, if you are in that situation in PD and you think that, okay, all right, if we're up against a deadline here, the 56-day deadline to get this through, and the council is saying there's not enough time here because we need to do this, we need to do this, we need to do this. Then you simply say to them, listen, if you need an extension, we can agree to it.
Yeah.
Because the law does actually state that even with PD and prior approval applications, where they say 56 days, you can agree to an extension.
Yeah.
And if they refuse to do so, then obviously they're being unreasonable. So you've got those sorts of situations as well. So, yeah, it can be incredibly irritating dealing with local authorities who just don't seem to know their beans. And you end up almost having to give them a lesson as you go along as well.
Mm. Graciously, of course.
Yes, indeed.
David, thank you. As I normally do, I've learnt plenty from your wise words.
David, if anybody wants to get in contact with you so that they can get some advice or use your services, how do they contact you?
The best way, Mark, would be to either email me at the following email address, which is david@drkkemp.co.uk. That's david@drkplanning.co.uk. Or you can send me a Facebook message via IM. You can find me on Facebook at David Kemp. I'm in all the progressive communities online as well, so look forward to hearing from you. Cheers.
Thank you for coming along. That has been Mark Homer for Mark My Words.